Russia says that the UK is spreading disinformation with accusations that Moscow is seeking to install an ally in neighboring Ukraine. A French soldier is killed in a mortar attack targeting a major military base in northern Mali. Plus, the fourth day of clashes between Kurdish-led forces and Daesh terrorists in northeastern Syria. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Bashar Sanjafi. Good to have you with us. The UK alleges that the Kremlin is trying to install a pro-Russia leader in Ukraine, and this is Moscow's response. It's nothing but nonsense and disinformation. The Russian Foreign Ministry is calling on the British Foreign Office to end such provocative activities and stop spreading nonsense. London says the Kremlin is considering a former Ukrainian lawmaker as a potential candidate. It also claims that Russia is gearing up to invade and occupy Ukraine. The Russian ministry says that the accusation is yet another indication that it is NATO members that are escalating tensions around Ukraine. In the meantime, the commander of the German Navy has resigned after his comments on Russia drew strong criticism from Ukraine. Kjartan Schoenbach says that the German defense minister has accepted his resignation, and this after the vice admiral called Russia an important country, admitting that Vladimir Putin, quote, probably deserves respect. He also said that the West claims that Russia is planning to invade Ukraine are, quote, nonsense. Kiev reacted by summoning Berlin's ambassador to protest the comments. Germany has also enraged Ukraine by refusing to deliver arms to the country. Berlin says that there is no consensus among German politicians over the issue. However, the U.S., Britain, and several Baltic states have agreed to provide Kiev with weapons. The first batch of the U.S. military aid arrived in Ukraine on Saturday. Now, it's been 7 years since the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution wrote two letters to the youth in Europe and North America, appealing to them to judge Islam and Muslims through the prism of their own unbiased research. A British economics professor has written a seminal book in response to Ayatollah Khamenei's letters, unpacking their message and asking if Islam really is the solution to global problems. Saeed Purza has been to the book launch event and sent us this report.
On behalf of the youth concerning justice for the world, a new paradigm response to the leader's letters to the youth in Western countries. The title of a 90-page book authored by retired British binary economics professor Rodney Shakespeare.
The book addresses the main issues for the world today. For example, there's massive inequality. There are preposterous accumulations of wealth. There's no justice. The exploitation of justice is, in fact, in the example that Iran is capable of giving as Iran develops the resistance economy.
The book, to be translated into multiple languages, picks up on two open letters penned by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the wake of a rise in terrorist attacks in 2015, among them the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris, which fueled Islamophobia in the West.
Islamophobia started immediately after Islamic Revolution in Iran. Although it surprised many in the world, they didn't have any strategy or plan, following which several false flag operations were created to damage the image of Islam, and it was necessary then to address the issue.
In those letters circulated widely online, Ayatollah Khamenei urged Western youth not to believe prejudiced portrayals of Islam by Western mainstream media or people in power, but to keep an open mind and judge the Muslim faith fairly.
The Muslim community are kind and peaceful people, and it's ridiculous to prejudice a whole huge community just because of the actions of one or two people that aren't following the faith that so many of them believe in, and that it's unfair.
More than anything, Professor Shakespeare's book is an economist's view on some of the biggest issues facing humanity. from the vices of capitalism to climate injustice, and whether Islam is the answer. The final chapter envisages the makeup of a true Islamic economy.
At the heart of an Islamic economy is the use of money, which is genuinely interest-free, not pretend. And when you understand that, when you understand that money is today created out of nothing, the way is open for a massive supply of interest-free money. As long as it goes out and is repaid and cancelled, and you can use it in countless ways.
In a world where Islamophobia, as well as economic and other injustices, are on the rise, Professor Shakespeare argues there is a need for a new reset, a paradigm shift. And it's exactly that paradigm shift, he proclaims, that terrifies the West. Said Bourizza, London.
Time now for the news review. A French military base in northern Mali has come under a mortar attack. A military source has attributed the Saturday strike to suspected militants. At least one French soldier has been killed. France is reorganizing its military presence in Mali after nearly 9 years of presence in the Sahel region. Now, under the plan, Paris would almost have the number of its personnel in the Sahel from 5,000 currently by next year. Relations between the two countries have been strained since the 2020 coup d'etat in Mali. Local officials want French troops to leave the country. There have also been public protests demanding the withdrawal of the French military. Now to discuss this, I'm joined by a couple of guests. We'll have Mustafa Taraora, academic and political analyst in Paris. Also with us will be Julius Mbalutu, political analyst in London. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now let me ask Mustafa, what is France doing in the Sahel region? What's France doing in Mali and Burkina Faso and elsewhere? What is it that they're pursuing there?
So France first arrived in Mali in 2012 when northern Mali was occupied by terrorists and the people who wanted to have their independence from the north of Mali. And when the agreement was signed between the government of Mali and the French, it was the government of Mali was asking for aircraft support. But what the French did, they came on the ground. And it seems that since they've arrived, the situation has worsened. But this is why the population of Mali is asking the French military to leave today. And if we analyze it, the problem was first in Mali, now it's situated in the whole region, which means that Burkina Faso is concerned. Many other countries, Niger is concerned. And what we know is that for sure is that the only reason why the French came is because they are trying to recolonize this part of the African continent. We know that those who provide the terrorists with weapons are the French. Those who help these separatists groups were the French. It is on the French TV that they declare their independence and autonomy. And on French TV, and they were French citizens as well. They had both nationalities, Malian nationality and French one. So this is the issue today. And today, it seems that since we had the military coup in Mali, the situation is improving. It is also improving because of thanks to the help of Russia. We know that the Russian army is in Mali, and this is what is disturbing the West, disturbing the French, because what the French did, without the consent of Mali, the Malians, they asked the whole European Union, okay, troops to come and be in Mali as well. The people of Mali were not asked. Even the agreements between Mali and France, no one in Mali has seen the documents. So the Malian authorities now are asking to see the documents because they know that what was asked for was an aircraft intervention support, not on the ground. So which means that the presence of the French army within in Mali is not legitimate.
Right. Now, Julius, how do you look at this? I mean, French government has its own issues, you know, and there are yellow vest protesters, anti-vaxxers, you know, unions out there, you know, almost every day they have their own rallies and they're making protests. And then it's trying to maintain its military presence outside of France, like in countries we mentioned, and now we're talking about Mali. And people in Mali, they don't want French war, they want them out.
We go back to history. A lot of African countries, people were protesting and they were fighting against colonialism, and they were yearning to have their own freedoms, independence, you know, aspects of it. But when you go to most of former French colonies in West Africa, you find even today they still use their currency, French currency. They don't even have currency of their own. When you look, if you are just from those countries, you're still using the currency of your former colonial master. Yet again, you see military power, military might on the ground, on boots, strolling around your country. It becomes a point whereby people ask, what is the essence of independence? What is the essence of freedom? And yes, we understand we are living in a global world. We understand global terror. We understand global efforts to combat terrorism, but actually how it works from African perspective is totally different, because when you're in a country in Africa, if you were left alone, some of these wars being fought are not African wars. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. Kenya, Tanzania bombed at the same simultaneously, 1998. US embassies were the targets, nothing to do with Tanzania, nothing to do with Kenya. And when you see the same thing, when you see France, what's happening? Yes, France is sending all this military might to combat terrorism. But the people on the ground, the Malians, they remember the colonial era. They don't want them there. And if you were to take away the French troops and you left the terrorists, maybe African governments could do something about it. And then maybe the war will end, because in the end, it's not an African war. It's war between militants, terrorists.
Right.
But their main target, Western countries. But who are victims? Countries that are seen as allies of the West.
Exactly. Mustafa, that's a good question I just wanted to ask you. If France really has good intention, why doesn't it simply empower the military in African countries, you know, to take care of their own security issues?
Yes, this is not in the interest of France, and this is why they are doing it. I was saying that this is not in the interest of France. So the France is having the strong Malian army is not in the interest of France, because if the Malian army becomes strong, they will have no point to stay in the country, to remain in the country, so and exploit the resources, because we know while you have all these issues, all these troubles with the terrorists, with the people from the north, that's the best moment for the French army to exploit the resources, to sign contracts, and so on. And this is how France intends to bring other European countries, saying, okay, if you come and help, if we start exploiting the resources, you will have your share. Okay? So this is what has been planned. And this is not what the Russians are doing, and this is why there is a good relationship between the Malian authorities today and the Russians, because the Russians, they train the soldiers, the Malian soldiers, and they give them the equipment at a very good price. And this is one fact now, it is very effective. No one is talking now about Azawad. Azawad is not even an issue today, because the Malian army is in Kidal. The Malian army is everywhere. No one is talking now about the divide, the division of the country. We saw last week when you had the protests, the demonstrations, you had people from Kidal demonstrating, saying, we are Malians. There's no difference between people from the north and the south. The only thing is that France wanted to take the minority from the north, sign contracts with them, and split the country into two, so that they could better exploit the country. Mm-hmm. The difference between the Russians and the French is that the Russians are going to train the army, the soldiers, and give them the equipment. The French are not going to even train the soldiers, and for sure, they're not going to give them the equipment. What is the point of being trained and you have no aircraft, for example.
Right.
You don't have the adequate weapons. There's no point.
And Julius, we have 1 minute. If you could tell us about how do you depict the future in terms of the French presence in Africa? Will it come to an end?
I've seen efforts by the former French colonies in West Africa coming together to come up with their own currency, which means the exact shared feelings of they want total independence. In terms of French engagement, away from harvesting of resources, there's no reason they need to be there. Mm-hmm. And I see also there's a different wave and a different approach coming from the southern part of Africa, and this is by SADC. We saw SADC countries not long ago coming together collectively to fight terrorists in Mozambique. And that coordination and wave, it is picked up by the rest of the blocs in Africa, like East Africa Community, like ECOWAS. It will be a question of African solutions to African problems. So hence the presence of these international countries, Western nations, trying to go to Africa most of the time, harvest resources in the name of war against terror, that will come to an end at some point.
Okay. I appreciate your comments and input. Mustafa Tarora, economic and political analyst in Paris, Julius Mbalogi, political analyst in London. Now moving on, Kurdish-led forces are tightening their siege on a jail in northeastern Syria that they say houses Daesh terrorists. They're trying to regain control of the prison following a riot there. It all began on Thursday when assailants ambushed a detention center in the city of Hasaka that's under the control of U.S.-led Kurdish forces. The attack left at least 70 detainees and more than a dozen guards dead. It also helped around 90 inmates flee and those remaining take over the prison. Kurdish forces saying that the attackers were Daesh terrorists seeking to release some 12,000 prisoners being held at that prison. Yemeni army has thwarted a major attack by Saudi-backed mercenaries in the northern province of Shabwa. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says that Yemeni forces targeted the gatherings of the militants with 4 ballistic missiles, inflicting heavy losses on them. It says that some 120 mercenaries were killed or wounded and a dozen armored vehicles were destroyed. Shabwa and the neighboring province of Marib have been the key fronts in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and regional allies, launched a war on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of reinstating a Riyadh-friendly regime there. Hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have been killed in the onslaught. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz. Every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat-3B and Iransat or BAD-5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We will be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Welcome back. The first part of the show went to Israel's Negev desert to reveal Dimona's hidden secrets. Dimona's core reactor is made of cement-coated metal. The fuel rods are inserted into the core where nuclear fusion takes place. Now, over the years, core absorbs tremendous amounts of heat and radiation, which slowly caused a degeneration of its materials. And the Dimona core, which was put into action back in 1963, was intended to be operational for up to 40 years, but it's exceeded the intended time frame by over a decade now. In fact, Israel is least threatened by the Dimona, having its population living in the north far from the reactor. 95% of the wind direction in Palestine is northwesterly, away from the Israeli localities, but towards Jordan and Palestine. Mordechai Benunu, the Israeli nuclear scientist and whistleblower, has long stated in interviews that Dimona's chimneys do not operate unless the wind blows in the direction of Jordan, and that Jordan should test residents in areas just across the border from the Dimona to be sure they have not already been exposed to radiation.
Israeli nuclear program is surrounded by a novel atmosphere. Arnon Milchan is a famous Hollywood producer behind films like Pretty Woman, Club of Fighters, or LA Confidential. He was also good friends with Benjamin Netanyahu. Recently, he revealed his double life. During all these years, he worked as a Mossad agent, helping Israel to buy technology needed to make nuclear weapons. Under a Hollywood producer cover, he was actually a kind of godfather of Israel's nuclear program. But there is no story like that of Mordechai Vananus. Vananu was a nuclear technician in Dimona till 1985. Before quitting, he snapped two rolls of film at the top secret nuclear plant. The world was stunned when the Sunday Times published Vananu's story and photos, exposing for the first time the secrets of Israel's nuclear arsenal in October 1986. But Israeli intelligence found Mordechai Vananu, and they waited for the right moment to strike. Sent a woman agent to seduce Mordechai Vananu in London and convince him to travel with her to Rome. Vananu was vulnerable and afraid and fell for Mossad's honey trap. The article was published on October the 5th, 1986. Vananu had vanished. His kidnap an illegal act on foreign soil was kept secret. Later, when Vanunu appeared for a secret court session in Jerusalem al-Quds, he found a way to reveal what had happened to him since he left London. Writing on his hand, Vanunu N was hijacked in Rome. Vanunu's trial was held in secret. He was found guilty of treason and espionage and sentenced to 18 years in jail, 11 of them in solitary confinement. The woman that seduced Vanunu was Cheryl Benthorne. After she completed her mission, she disappeared back into her secret world. Today, she lives back in Orlando, USA, with her husband and two daughters, running a real estate business. Vanunu's revelations confirmed suspicions and showed a weapons program bigger and more advanced than anyone had previously thought. Mordecai Vanunu was released in 2004, but he is not a free man. Israeli borders are now his prison. His passport was confiscated and he cannot contact foreigners.
This Jewish state have 200 atomic weapons, have hydrogen bomb, atomic weapons, neutron bomb, and they are not able to say they have the bomb. They are not able to destroy anyone. They are not able to use the bomb. Instead, they arrest Vanunu Mordecai.
Dimona's symbol, the only building seen from far away. A 20 meters high nuclear reactor dome. In 1986, Vanunu took us inside. Heavy water reactor built in the 50s with France and Norway's help, with a capacity of 24 megawatts. Thanks to Vanunu, we learned that this reactor capacity is three or possibly even five times larger than assumed. This reactor produces 40 kilograms of plutonium a year, enough to build 10 to 12 atomic bombs. Adjacent to the reactor is Institute No. 3. Here, the fuel rods powering the reactor are produced, together with lithium-6, another ingredient of the bomb. Institute No. 5. Here, the fuel rods are coated with the aluminium. Institute No. 6 is the power station of the compound. The lab is in Institute No. 8, and inside is another secret revealed by Mordecai Vanunu. This is where Israel produces enriched uranium. Like plutonium, it can serve as fissionable material for the bomb. The uranium is produced through gas centrifuges. Enriched uranium is also produced in Institute No. 9 using laser, a unique Israeli patent. Institute No. 10 produces the depleted uranium, an important component in the production of armor-piercing shells. Institute No. 4 handles the radiation waste prior to it being disposed. And long two-story building with no windows is Dimona's biggest secret. Institute No. 2. Beneath the two innocent-looking floors, hidden underground, are six additional floors. It was Vanunu who showed the world what no satellite could see. Here, Israel set up a plutonium separation facility with one goal: manufacturing of atomic bombs. In the 60s, American inspectors visited the first floor. They saw the restaurants and the offices. A special wall was constructed, hiding the elevators leading to the underground levels. Back outside, trucks bring in the processed uranium rods. Through the large doors, a crane grasps the rods and lowers them to the big workspace four floors below. The rods are dipped in nitrous acid tanks, cooked for about 30 hours, and then a system of pipes draws the water containing the uranium and plutonium. Through a chemical process, the materials are separated and then baked in an oven, producing a small 130-gram plutonium ball, 1.7 kilograms a week, 4 kilograms, and it's a bomb. Just as shot by Vanunu, the process can be viewed from level 2. Balcony was built for distinguished guests, nicknamed Golda's Balcony. and that's the control room as shot by Bannerman. Only 150 employees are authorized to enter it. Visits are limited to the Prime Minister, the Ministry of Military Affairs, and a small group of confidants. Equipped with a hidden camera, Vanunu walked about Institute No. 2 and took pictures of the different sections. Not only plutonium is produced here. At level No. 4, Vanunu revealed the production of tritium used in the production of thermonuclear bombs, which are more powerful than ordinary atomic bombs. Two other essential materials for the bomb are produced here, lithium and deuterium. All these ingredients are taken to level 5, to unit MD2, the metal department, where they are assembled into a bomb. One level down is a recreation room where Vanunu shot what experts identified as a model of an Israeli thermonuclear bomb. 10 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Experts that analyzed Vanunu's testimony determined that by the 80s, Israel had produced 100 to 200 atomic bombs. This ranks Israel as the 6th or even 5th nuclear power in the world. From Amman, we travel to southern Jordan. High cancer rates were recorded in all the southern Jordanian governments, which confirms the possible direction of nuclear dust that might be leaking from Dimona. Tips we received claim that in Jordan there are hundreds of cases of cancer and other diseases, all of them in the regions near the border with Israel. From Tal Afar to Dimona, it is about 30 kilometers, and winds or water knows no borders. In almost every house in this region, we can find the same story: diseases and death. Dimona is a word that everybody knows around here. But in Jordan, like in Israel, Dimona and its deadly consequences are a taboo. Saleh is a tour guide and an activist. For years, he is trying to uncover what is happening to the people around the Tafila region. Our next stop is in Tafila. Here, the average manifestation of cancer is higher than the other Jordanian governorates and surrounding Arab countries. Going to visit the governor's office, where we are going to meet the mayor and the governor of the region. It's a surprise what we are going to hear. People around Tafila region are dying from cancer in high numbers. Doctors link the cases to Dimona contamination. But officially, nobody can say it, not even the ones that are dying. Dana is an amazing natural treasure in Jordan, too close to Dimona. Bassem Saudi was born here, in this land, a step away from Dimona nuclear plant. He knows that his people are dying silently and wants answers that never come. Is Dimona nuclear plant poisoning its Arab neighbors? While we were filming with Bassem Saudi, some guards at the Dana Natural Reserve approach us. They want to break their silence. They also have a story to tell about how Dimona is killing their families. Syria back in Palestine to visit some villages south of Al-Khalil, very close to the Negev Desert and Dimona. Here, the cancer rates are growing in alarming numbers. The causes are not more than rumors. Nuclear radioactive leakage from Dimona and nuclear waste dumps in the area, or even both. We try to find a clear answer to these rumors in Berlin with Xanther Hall.
200 cubic meters a year were produced in Dimona, and it's been running for more than 40 years. We can estimate about 8,000 cubic meters of waste, radioactive waste, have been, as the bottom line, have been produced. And to try and imagine what that is, it's maybe, in a picture, 50,000 standard barrels of oil would be about 8,000 cubic meters. We also don't know where they bury this waste. They say that it's not far from the reactor, and the main problem that we're looking at here is what state are these stainless steel containers in? Are they corroded? Will they be leaking? Are they seeping into the ground, into the water sources? Are we seeing pollution of the environment, and therefore of people's health? I mean, I don't know exactly the geography of the area, but there it's chalk, and I imagine that the whole area is probably also chalk, and that is not a good area to be deposing any kind of waste. And they saw that with this toxic waste dump, because there was leakages and serious health problems were discovered. So I would imagine that it would be similar in the area around Dimona, because it's not far away. And also whether it gets into the water or not, because once it gets into the water, then it transports much further into other areas and people can drink it that are quite far away. So then we're talking about basically that there would be cancers later on, or leukemia, and in particularly the children would be badly affected, because children, and especially women, are more susceptible to radiation. The effects on them are much greater than grown men, for instance. I would say that those are the ones that we have found, definitely in the studies that have been done around nuclear installations in Germany, that the main problem was childhood cancer. And in the areas surrounding plutonium reprocessing plants like Sellafield, in the UK, the main problem was leukemia.
The radioactivity has a tremendous power that can penetrate the human gene, affecting generation after generation. Jamal is a Palestinian policeman. He was arrested after the Second Intifada and spent 13 years in jail. Now he is free, but living a new hell. His daughter has cancer. At the age of 9, she was diagnosed with leukemia. Nothing in the medical report says this Palestinian girl is a direct victim of Dimona. But she comes from an area that counts 70% of cancer cases among the Palestinian population. Israel is probably the 6th or even 5th nuclear power in the world. While others should open the doors of their nuclear programs for inspections, Israel is a special case, producing nuclear weapons since the 60s without any control. Meanwhile, the cancer cases and other diseases are spreading across Israel, Palestine, and neighboring Arab countries. The victims die without knowing what or who is killing them.
Even if Dimona's deadly weapons of mass destruction are never used, still, the reactors and silently killing masses of defenseless citizens throughout the decades, and it continues doing so. By continuing to maintain and operate the Dimona reactor, Israel is committing a crime against humanity that will be added to the atrocities that have perpetrated throughout its history. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Join us next time for another documentary right here. Until another episode of Aperture, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. How many times in life have you had an opportunity knock on your door, and then for whatever the reason you took too long to answer that door, and that opportunity went away because it probably thought no one was home? How many times has that happened in your life? I know it's happened in my life often because I took too long to respond to that opportunity, whether it was because of anxiety, whether it was because I was too distracted with other things. Those things could have been important, those things could have been unimportant, whatever. But the point is, an opportunity was presented, a door was opened, and then I neglected it and whooshed, it went away. Do you guys like fish, by the way? It might sound at first that it's got nothing to do with opportunities, but once you listen to the story we have in store, you'll change your mind. We'll be right back.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear friends, we have a nice story for this part. Thank you very much for listening to Lantern, Two Fishermen. One day the two fishermen were fishing in a nearby pond. Both of them were looking forward to have a fresh fish afterwards. They both have packed utensils, cooking accessories, ingredients, and fishing equipment. Once they arrived at the pond, they chose to sit at a distance to hunt for fishes. The first fisherman caught a big and beautiful fish within a few minutes. He was very happy. He then placed the fish in the icebox to retain its freshness. He would cook it whole fish in the noon. He caught a few more other small fishes after a while. He froze a few fishes to take it back home. After about an hour of fishing, the first fisherman offered to help the second fisherman. The second fisherman politely declined, and the second fisherman also caught a large fish. Surprisingly, he threw it back into the pond. The first man was bewildered by his act. He remained silent as he watched the second man capture many big fishes only to have them thrown back into the water. The first fisherman, annoyed by this act, retorted, "Why are you throwing the fishes back into the water? They were beautiful and big." The second fisherman replied, "I know they were big, but I don't have a big pan to cook the big fishes, so I'm looking for a smaller fish that fits my cooking pan." The first fisherman was startled by the response. He advised the second fisherman to cut the big fish into pieces to fit them into the small pan. Yeah, many of us are just like the second fisherman. We tend to overlook a handful of opportunities, chances, and even fortune that come in our way because we are too stubborn in looking for what we want. We need to learn to capture every opportunity and work it out so that it will fit into our lives perfectly. Most do not understand the wonderful opportunities life gives until they are looking back. The sentence was from Eric Handler.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at this story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
That is the case with the opportunities in life as well. If we lose sight of them and we tell ourselves that, yeah, it's always going to be there. Before we know it, we'll raise our head and we'll see that that floof of cloud we had been watching 2 minutes ago is gone. So it's really important for us not to lose objective, not to lose perspective, and to constantly stay focused on what we want to achieve so that when opportunities that can further serve that objective present themselves in our life, we don't lose sight of them and we don't miss out. Another narration from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam reads quite a similar narration actually, and it tells us that whomsoever a door of opportunity opens for, they must value it because they don't know when this door is going to close. We really don't. Or in another narration, His Eminence says that missing out on opportunities in life is one of the causes for sadness and grief. So God knows, maybe a lot of us who are miserable, I know I am sometimes, is because we don't have that sense of fulfillment in life. It's because we feel that we haven't lived up to our fullest potential, we haven't achieved anything, and that in reality we've lost all those good opportunities that were presented to us that could have made us a better person and could have ended in better results in our life. The solution? Well, I personally am still trying to figure it out, but I could say one of that is to stay vigil, to keep an open mind and keep an open heart to the opportunities that present themselves in our lives. And that is only possible if we set a goal for ourselves, if we have a certain set of principles, if we discipline and train ourselves and determine a path, a course that we want to take in our life and the goal that we want to reach, then and only then will we be able to recognize the opportunities that come along and have the encouragement, have the inspiration, have the morale, and have the courage to seize those opportunities and make the best of them. If we don't have an objective in life, and if we don't have discipline, we won't feel any inclination toward opportunities, because we'd feel, so what? What am I going to do with this now? We don't have a cause that we'd wish to serve through the means of this opportunity. So I think that's the most important thing we can do for ourselves. And it's the most important thing we can do to find meaning and fulfillment in our lives. Not to feel useless, not to feel like a piece of trash, not to feel like our life sums up to nothing, and we are nothing, and we've achieved nothing. It's important to set goals and to be disciplined enough to attain them. There are tens and tens of narrations that talk about this matter, and many, many, many verses in the Quran that discuss this. And it's quite logical that those instructions should exist, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says so himself in the Quran that we have not created heaven and earth and this world and all these complex, beautiful, various creations for nothing. They're all created to serve a common divine objective. They're all moving toward a common direction. And for us to think otherwise is just undermining our own existence. It's not going to hurt or harm God in any way if I think that He did not create me, or that I didn't have a purpose, I just happened. But it's going to drain and rob me and my life of all sense of meaning and life, really. Don't lose hope. Everything is going to be okay. Tomorrow's a new day. You got this. Just seize the moment. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.